My opening words were chosen to highlight and reflect the truth behind the saying that beside every great man is a great woman. Therefore, I present some words about Coretta Scott King from various sources. Mrs. King was no stranger to terrorism. In 1942, as a child, she had seen her home on the outskirts of Marion, Alabama, burned to the ground on Thanksgiving Eve. Quote, "Through it all, my father never hated those who did that terrible thing. He just picked himself up and fearlessly started over again. My burned out home prepared me for the fires next time in Montgomery. My father, his example of forgiveness deepened my understanding of the commitment needed to face and eventually triumph with love over hate." End quote. Mrs. King attended Antioch College in Ohio and studied music on scholarship. She next attended the New England Conservatory of Music in Boston, where she met Martin Luther King. They married and moved to Montgomery, Alabama, where he was chosen to lead the Montgomery bus boycott. Quote, "I was a partner in the movement. When whites bombed our home in Montgomery, Alabama, I was in the home with my infant daughter. We could have been killed, but I refused to give in to fear." Regarding the Montgomery bus boycott, she said, "I knew this was history making, and I also knew that it was not only happening in Montgomery, but it was, the impact of this was much further, more extensive than Montgomery, because during the Montgomery boycott, we heard that there was a boycott in Johannesburg, South Africa, of buses, and also there was one in Mobile and in Tallahassee. The struggle was much bigger than a boycott. It was about the injustices in our society. It was about changing the society and changing the laws of the government locally and certainly nationally." After Martin's death, Mrs. King was still very active in many national events and causes. She planned and helped create the Martin Luther King Center for Nonviolence and Social Change in Atlanta. She successfully lobbied for his birthday to become a national holiday. She opposed apartheid and traveled to South Africa to meet with Winnie Mandela, wife of Nelson Mandela. In 1998, she called upon the civil rights community to join in the struggle against homophobia and anti-gay bias. Quote, "Homophobia is like racism and anti-Semitism and other forms of bigotry in that it seeks to dehumanize a large group of people, to deny their humanity, their dignity, and their personhood. This sets the stage for further repression and violence that spread all too easily to victimize the next minority group." I'd like to invite Pam Santos to come forward to deliver our first sermonette.
Hello. Hi. Walking the walk began with me in earnest as a parent. My husband and I are blessed with five wonderful children, three of European descent and two of African descent. Having a multiracial family is not some attempt at social harmony, righting a past wrong, or doing the right thing, not at all. Our family looks the way it does because of our love of parenting and our willingness to embrace the joys and challenges of a big and busy family. And yet, it is because of my big and busy family that I cannot look away from racism, pretend not to see racial issues in my country, my community, or myself. I'm the mother of two young boys who will grow up to be black men in a country with an ugly racial history. My sons love to tell the story of Martin Luther King Jr. and how he stood up for the rights of all people, regardless of skin color. And as a family, we cheered as we watched President Barack Obama being sworn in on TV. These are easy conversations to have with my children. It will not be so easy to explain the racial climate in our country where the percentage of black men is grossly overrepresented in our prisons, in violent deaths, and unemployment. It will be difficult to explain to my sons why they're being closely watched in the candy store, or why they're more likely to be pulled over as they learn to drive. In our family, we do not pretend to be colorblind. We compare skin tones. We talk about melanin. We learn about why our African relatives had darker skin, our Scottish relatives had lighter skin, and the Portuguese were somewhere in between. We know that people originated from Africa, making us all brothers, and yet some people will see us only skin deep. In our family, we talk about racism. At nighttime, we not only read Goodnight Moon, but we read Mr. Lincoln's Way and The Other Side. They're both beautiful kids' stories that encourage talk about race, racial issues and racism. I've talked to my sons about racism the way I've talked to my daughters about women's issues. It's a mom's job. I've shared with my 7 and 8-year-old sons some of the ugly language used by racists. I want my sons to know that I'm aware of these words. I'm not afraid, and they can come to me if they ever hear this kind of ugly language. These conversations break my heart. It would be so much easier to look away and pretend that I didn't need to have these conversations. But racism is a part of our world, and it's a part of our communities, even part of our families. Confronting racism does not need to be a loud demonstration of your values. It can be a small conversation with a child. You do not need to join an organization or put a bumper sticker on your car, but you might need to calmly confront a relative who makes an ignorant comment. You don't need to go to a huge protest, but you might want to visit your neighbor of color, introduce yourself, and share a cup of tea. As a white woman, there are very few times, if any, in my life that racial prejudice will impact me here in my hometown. I could decide that racial injustice simply is not my problem. I could politely explain that I was colorblind and really didn't think that race was such an issue. Yet, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, in the end, we will not remember the words of our enemies, but the silence of our friends. I choose not to be silent. All 5 of my children watch how my husband and I respond to racism. Young people in your lives are watching too. Our UU principles remind us of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, compassion in human relations, and the goal of justice. As a Unitarian Universalist, I cannot look away from racism. As a mother, I cannot look away from racism. I look for opportunities to engage in discussion, to make a difference, and to walk the walk against racism. I invite you to walk with me.
I now invite Gail Burschacht to come forward to give us our sermonette number 2.
Good morning. I'm sorry that Val is not able to be here to fill in for Penny, and that Penny is not here, and hopefully she's enjoying her time with her family and the warmth. But I am happy to be able to read what Penny had written. This is one way we walked our talk. In 1981, a group of black and white parents and concerned citizens met to discuss the racial situation in South Kingston schools, where many students of color felt discouraged and in some cases invisible. I was one of the parents. We formed the South County Coalition Against Racism and worked together with and in the schools for over 20 years to improve the situation. There were very few teachers of color on the faculty, which meant that both white and black students had almost exclusively white role models at school. It was not surprising that black students often didn't relate to their teachers, or that white students didn't question their sometimes racist assumptions. While urging the school committee to take a proactive stance on hiring teachers of color, we decided to provide some immediate role models. For many years, we gathered together panels of African and Native American adults who were willing to talk about their journeys in assemblies in the middle and high schools. There were policemen, newscasters, lawyers, actors, social workers, educators, business people, and more who shared their struggles and successes with the students and answered their questions in follow-up sessions. We also brought in assembly speakers, theater productions, and artists in residence, all to expose all our students to more cultural diversity and richness, more options for more people. We also raised funds for a scholarship to be given annually to the graduating senior who had done the most to contribute to the cause of racial justice. Teachers and students had to think about whom to nominate, which highlighted the goal of racial justice every year. As we interviewed the nominees, we were encouraged to hear how often they mentioned being inspired by one of our role model panelists or invited guests. That was exciting. Realizing how significant it is for kids to have individual personal support, we started a fledgling mentoring program for URI students to volunteer at West Kingston Elementary School. Under the leadership of Coalition member Al Killeley, the mentoring program has become an amazingly successful project, which brings in URI mentors to work with kids in schools all over the state. What did we learn in all those years of working with the schools? We were humbled by the pervasive long-term effects of racism in our society. Our efforts certainly didn't solve the problems, but we learned that we were welcome to work with people in the schools, that we could do more by connecting than by criticizing. By working together, we could help provide a climate to stimulate all kids to grow. As the Unitarian Reverend Edward Everett Hale said so well, "I cannot do everything, but I still can do something. And because I cannot do everything, I will not refuse to do the something that I can do." Thank you, Penny.
And now John Glasheen will present our third and final sermonette.
Essentially what I want to talk about is growing up in a racist community and seeing that change. And I'm going to try to read this without glasses, which may I grew up in Northampton, Massachusetts in the 1940s and 1950s as part of a folk culture, meaning particularly before there was television. Northampton was a town of 30,000 people, predominantly working class, with perhaps half a dozen Negro families in the vernacular of the time. I know only one, Mary R., who delivered newspapers for a living. I had no idea where she lived or with an extended family, nor did I have any idea where the small number of other Negroes lived. There were no black slums, no local issues, but I had a strong racist attitude anyway. Where did it come from? It came directly from my mother's mouth. My mom was a single parent before it was popular. She made her living as a home economist who ran school lunch programs and then as a third grade teacher. She had gone to college because she had attended Deerfield Academy, where she grew up. Her friends were all working class, predominantly Irish Catholics, mostly clerks and laborers, then other elementary school teachers. In my youth, I had virtually no contact with any professional class of persons or families, nor wider ethnic contacts. My world was Irish Catholic, a folk Irish Catholic. As I grew up under her influence, I was frequently exposed to her views of other ethnics. You know what they're like, and you can substitute anything in there, French, Italian, Polish, and especially Jews, who were Christ killers, and Negroes, who were pickaninnies recently brought out of the jungle and designated for inferior positions in almost any situations. I was then exposed to an apparently different view. I attended Deerfield Academy, where my classmates had names like Rockefeller, Duke, Wurlitzer, Maytag, and John Vincent Peale. I attended Brown University, where I majored in American Studies. And I taught for 2 years in prep school till I found out I didn't know anything. There were virtually no blacks in these institutions, nor in the history that was taught. So I decided to fill my head with historical facts, going to graduate school where I was conditionally accepted, packed up my wife and 2 children, and started a year in graduate school with $54 cash reserves. In my first semester, I studied someone by the name of W.E.B. Du Bois, of whom I had never heard, and I assume that probably a third of you, 50 years later, probably still have never heard. His Souls of Black Folk had been written in 1903, when he received his PhD from Harvard University. In reading Du Bois, I read his reactions to the death of his infant son. And I had a son of approximately the same age as I was reading that. I will need the glasses for this. All that day and all that night, there sat an awful gladness in my heart. Nay, blame me not if I see the world thus darkly through the veil. And my soul whispers ever to me, saying, not dead, but escaped. Not bond, but free. No bitter meanness now shall sicken his baby heart till it dies a living death. No taunt shall madden his happy boyhood. Fool that I was to think or wish that this little soul should grow choked and deformed within the veil. Idle words. He might have borne his burden more bravely than we. Aye, and found it lighter too someday. For surely this is not the end. Surely there shall yet dawn some mighty morning to lift the veil and set the prison free. Not for me, I shall die in my bonds, but for fresh young souls who have not known the night and waken to the morning, a morning when men ask of workmen not, is he white, but can he work? When men ask artists not, are they black, but do they know? Some morning this may be, long, long years to come, but now there wails on that dark shore within the veil the same deep voice, thou shalt forego. And all I have foregone at that command, and with small complaint, all save that fair young form that lies so coldly wed in death in the nest I had builded. The emotional impact of his words significantly changed my world. I became active in civil rights and came to see Du Bois as one of the most significant figures in American history and critical to the development of black consciousness. I then went to edit a U.S. history textbook, which was adopted in Texas, which was the first mention of Du Bois to secondary school students in this country. And I pulled out a copy of it to validate. 1970, the first mention of W.E. Du Bois in a secondary school history text. Knowledge and empathy are the correlations for our seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. And Du Bois was my source.
My closing words today, nonviolence is the way. And before we enter our closing circle, I would like to remind you about a book called Acts of Faith, written by Eboo Patel. He writes about his coming of age as a Muslim in America. He chronicles his work as founder and director of the Interfaith Youth Council, a nonprofit interfaith organization originally founded in Chicago. His book has been selected by the UUA as a common read. Common Ground is sponsoring a discussion group regarding his experience. His book is available in our library, and we invite you to join us starting in March for interesting conversations.